All right, I'd like to welcome our speakers up to the stage for our discussion. I think we will gather by the seeds that have been left behind by Novotic. All right. So we will open things up to the audience in just a few moments, but I think we've been given many seeds of thought from the presentations that we've had, and especially from the performance that we've just had here. I think the first question, if I may come up with a question to toss out for us to imagine and to consider here, is the focus on seeds. Is seeds really the thing that we have concluded that we're talking about here? Or is it organisms in general? We had a session on non-generic genetics, but then we heard statements like it's no longer viable to do certain things in crops, or that microbes are the future. And I think we've seen a very other form of life just presented to us on stage here today. And I'm curious if seeds is a useful frame for us still, or if seeds is much larger, encompassing many other possibilities. Anyone has some thoughts on how we might reframe seeds now after having heard from each other, or particular things that we might resonate from presentations that we've heard, something that struck your mind?
Well, if we're talking about physical seeds, then no. But seeds as objects that are these potent condensations of vital potentiality seem to be a through line for all of us, the ways in which we've been talking about possible futures, whether optimistic or pessimistic, and what kind of life might flourish there or not, is a point that I think we could all agree upon.
Yeah, I think also like of seeds of heirlooms, which is something that you were talking about. The seeds today, it's more like information. So before, we can think like as the seed as something that was containing that information that would give some certain form of life. I think today, and that was a kind of like heirloom that we were trying to protect and that we're still trying to protect. And now we're moving into some other like vision of this heirloom as in DNA as a way to sort of like enclose and protect those properties of life, and both seeds can arise like a potential, like you say, like positive or negative scenarios.
I would say that seeds in this sense, not as a physical object, but it's our gateways between something that existed and something that will exist. So, it's like Janus with the two faces.
And this idea of latent life that we also heard, right?
Yeah. So I think that it's also true from all of the discussion, everything. It's also true that we are in a gateway now from transforming from one way of doing engineering or synthetic to a new way of doing engineering or synthetic. So basically, we are basically in the seed situation. One face in the past, as you both gave the perspective, and one face in the future of how we are going to revolutionize the way we used to do things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For us, I think it was a that moment when Khatun asked us to participate on that panel, it was really the seed in the agriculture. So we were thinking what technology and economics and things change our way of seeing the seeds. But dealing with the topic of synthetic biology and further on, we recognized a lack of imagination. So that we said, there is no possibility to imagine that landscape, what happens now inside the scientists, inside the laboratories, inside also education. So there is no idea of a landscape what we are dealing with, because it's so small, it's so hidden behind the surfaces of the laboratories. So therefore we ask, how can you deal with that? Not as a solution, but only to look at for this change of needed change of view.
So imagination as a fundamental part of how we rethink seeds. That also seems to be a trajectory I've seen over the presentations today, that I had mentioned McClintock, who said that the real point is control, and that was the major thing. And then Helena, you had said that we should stop being obsessed with control. And I hear a turn to imagination as another way to think of other possibilities and other alterities. So are we done with control as a way of thinking about seeds, and we're looking for other ways of opening up that topic? Is that what I'm hearing?
But then there is no engineering.
Then there's
engineering is control, uh-huh. Basically. That's what you are trying to do in engineering. In synthetic, which is not engineering.
I think that's not totally correct. I mean, you have this quote from François Jacob, but it was taken out of context, right? This idea that engineering is the opposite of tinkering. Of course, François Jacob was reading Claude Lévi-Strauss, and when Claude Lévi-Strauss wrote about tinkering, he wrote about what he termed bricolage. Bricolage in itself was much more powerful than any form of engineering because it had to do with making do with the materials at hand and finding creative solutions for problems you didn't even realize you had yet. So it strikes me that actually tinkering is something that might be a more apt metaphor for synthetic biology than engineering ever was. And with regard to this imaginative capacity, I think it's important to recall, and I don't want to take words out of your mouth, but I heard on a loop Donna Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto, in which, you know, she says that our machines are very lively and we are disturbingly inert. So it seems that, in fact, what we're talking about is a kind of tinkering or bricolage with machines that, as you said, are so complex that they sometimes surprise us, right? That they are doing things that are much more lively than perhaps our best intentions for them might be.
So I would agree completely that what we are doing up to 10 years ago was, even in synthetic biology, was much more tinkering than anything else. It's much more playing with a system without, even without control, and see what we get, and using our imagination to see where we go. And what some of us are trying to do is to try to make it more controllable or more engineering-like or more, you know, mathematical framework to describe stuff, trying to, you know where we are and try to know exactly where we will be, although it's very difficult.
Yeah, but we're never really going to be able to do that.
Probably not.
No.
But we can try.
Like, we can think of engineering as a nice metaphor to explain what we're doing, but yeah. The thing with biological systems is that we will never going to engineer them, and the field should acknowledge that, and also what does it mean, and maybe we should, like what we were saying, maybe we need another framework, another imaginary and of how we're going to interact with nature, and yeah, many things are easy, and it's easy to think of organisms as machines because they're so complex, and we want to control things because we want to control the future as well, right? In case of a catastrophe, we want to be able to say, oh, we can't control how the crops will grow because we will have better crops. But I think we should also imagine all kinds of scenarios and maybe think of the present as well.
But who is that we? So that's also our question, who is part of these possibilities to create imagination? And so it's also that trust what we had to the scientists, the dream that they find the solution for all our problems, that's now the case.
Definitely a very diverse we. We see also here, including between the scientists, it's a very diverse we. There is definitely not a homogenic we, but it's good. I think that's...
We're all asking each other these questions. I mean, people from humanities, from the arts, from the scientists, I guess also politicians are wondering about how do we cope with these questions. And it's just we need to find ways to interact with each other and to learn from each other. I don't have the solution, but I think communicating.
So not just that we will all be bioengineers at some point, as you said, but we will all be many things.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would love that people would manipulate living systems so that they get an idea of what it is. And I would also love that scientists, for once, they get out of the lab and then they interact with the real world and that with people that will be impacted by those technologies and learn from the arts and learn from historians, like, yeah.
So one thing that is really clear in the modern society that everyone becomes very specialized in what he's doing, and it's something that many people discuss. So if at the past you can talk about a Renaissance man that can master both, you know, the physical world and the humanities and so on, now each of us is so concentrated on the small things we are doing, it's this interaction is becoming much more challenging. And definitely in issues that are so controversial, like synthetic biology, which opens so many questions, we need to, in a sense, force this communication in a very specialized world, which is a big challenge.
So I want to open it to the audience in just a few minutes here, but a question for Sophia, I think, about the materiality of seeds that you described Svalbard, and you described that there's this incredible repository and archive of actual material things that are there, and yet we also know from the things we've been learning about synthetic biology that materiality may not be a part of how the engineers think about what they're doing, that it's about abstraction, it's about hierarchy. So I guess my question would be, how much does the material aspect or nature of seeds actually matter anymore?
I think materiality is profoundly important in this case. For one thing, if we are imagining a dystopic future, that dystopic future will not include sequencing and synthesis machines. So the notion of code is no longer useful in that imaginary. But even beyond some kind of science fictional storytelling.
So that's after the world ends in 2047.
Yes. But even beyond, you know, science fictional tropes about apocalypse, the function of the seed vault is more or less the obverse of what seed vaults were meant to do, or caches of seeds were meant to do during the Green Revolution, right? Which were also physical material seeds, and yet during the Green Revolution, when seeds were transferred between countries, they were incredibly homogenous, right? There was one strain of, you know, Norman Borlaug's wheat that was being brought to Mexico or to India, and one of the things that I find really profound about the Svalbard seed vault is that it is meant to be a global repository, right? It's not particular to the Norwegian government, although the Norwegian government in part manages it, but also that it is all about the diversity of the seeds, not about trying to have homogenous land races that are going to in some way improve crop production in the way that the Green Revolution promised. And of course, the Green Revolution was an abject failure, and many countries suffered profoundly because of the use of pesticides and the need for increased irrigation. So this is a way of trying to imagine a future agricultural system that would perhaps, if not fix many of the problems of the Green Revolution, try to avoid those pitfalls.
So imagination is at the heart of the construction of this seed repository then, is what I'm hearing, many different possible futures. Interesting. Why don't we open it up to the audience? I believe we have microphones that are available. Is there a question for our panel from the room? Yes,
hi.
I see over here. Yes.
So I want to ask or maybe contest something about the notion of, like, tinkering that's used and the notion of bricolage that's used, or like maybe the way that they're like equated, or okay, so I think some of you, when you've been talking about like tinkering or like bricolage, you know, you're saying something that's, I don't know, that the colloquialism for would be something like MacGyvering, you know, in terms of like you have some limited set of means and you like hack something together to sort of like see where it could possibly take you or see whether it can like approximate a goal. But the, you know, the more like formal sense of like tinkering that was introduced during Arendt's lecture, you know, referred specifically to the idea of, you know, tinkering as local optimization or like a greedy algorithm or like a hill climbing process, you know, and that like implies something a lot more like constraining than I think the idea of like bricolage or MacGyvering or like improvisation. Is the idea that, you know, in some sense, like, it's the opposite of imagination. It means that you can't get like anywhere if the path towards there isn't like one of like constant improvement, right? It means that you can sort of like make an imaginative leap over like a gap in like a process of constant improvement. So I think maybe it could be interesting to say something about whether we could have the kind of like imaginative leaps that are part of like engineering as opposed to tinkering as Aaron described it, and also maybe have the, you know, like improvisational or like bricolage like spirit that we seem to be right now maybe finding more inspiring than like the engineering spirit in the sense of like total control.
Okay, so Aaron?
So I would say, I guess that I will not get agreement here, but for my perspective, engineering is definitely more of a leap of imagination than tinkering could ever be, because tinkering, basically you are still limited to the existing system. You could be completely, you know, out of the system to go to completely new places with engineering. And I think this is something we are just now becoming, you know, thinking more out of the box and becoming, being able to do it more and more. But I think that if, hopefully, if the world does not end in 2047, then we will have the chance to get to a place that we can completely redesign biological system or redesign life to our needs. And I agree that, you know, you can never completely engineer it because of its complexity. But I think that if we really want to be innovative, it's only the engineering would be the point, but I'm sure that Sophia does not agree with me, so.
Well, I think, thank you for your comment, but I believe my intervention was a little bit misheard. I wasn't trying to compare engineering and tinkering or to suggest that those two are binary opposites. I was rather just trying to clarify what François Jacob meant when he used the term tinkering, given the literature that he was reading at the time, and to say that even, you know, when he was talking about tinkering, he was thinking about it on a continuum with engineering, not as something that was engineering's opposite.
Okay. By the way, you said something very similar, if I may say. You said that what we are doing now is qualitatively similar to what we have done before, just quantitatively different. This is was.
I never said that.
It was in the part of you know, at the beginning of this is, you know, this was echoed with me a bit, this thing that, you know, are we, for Monsanto, for example, the example that you gave for Monsanto, that they put, you know, the start of the story 12,000 years ago and so on.
That's right, yeah.
So from my perspective, there is a qualitative difference, not just the quantitative difference. And I agree that Monsanto would do it, as you said, to show that they are not actually doing something new. But actually, the change, I think, is massive. And change that, you know, to do something in the dark, to play with, you know, to throw darts in the dark, or to be with your eyes open, knowing the system, and doing something, I think that is a big qualitative change.
No, I'm not trying to say that, you know, synthetic biology is either really newly new or on a continuum with earlier examples of agriculture, animal husbandry. Rather, I'm much more interested in the stakes of the claims that people themselves are making. So just as a brief example, I spoke to a synthetic biologist who told me, well, sometimes, you know, when I'm talking to reporters, I describe what I'm doing as really novel and no one has ever done it before and it's cutting edge breakthrough work because that's how I want to promote my research.
And get funding.
And get precisely, and he mentioned funding as well. And he said, but if I'm talking to ethicists or policymakers, I say, oh, I'm not doing anything different than what we've been doing for 12,000 years. So my point is that the ways in which we carve up the world and the decisions we make about saying whether what we're doing is new or not have meaningful on-the-ground stakes for the practices and the context in which that kind of scientific work is getting done.
Yeah.
And so the imaginations of possible applications and futures that are revealed is also something to pay attention to, not just the ones that exist. I was struck by the fact that when I look at the accounts from a century ago, the visions that are put forward are so positive, that anything could be engineered, better crops, better food, better flowers, anything that would be possible. And things seem to change right around 1948, by chance. And suddenly there's much more concern about mutations that could be bad or that things could not go in a positive way. And certainly I think that intensifies in the 70s and is part of what you were kind of getting out with some of the GMO debate and discussions that you were saying. So the futures also seem to have this historical character. They look very different at different moments in time. And the apocalyptic nature of the seed bank itself is kind of the ultimate transformation from an earlier moment of what could go wrong to a moment of what do we do when everything has gone wrong? How do we make sure that we're insured for that moment? So just a thought. Is there another question from the audience? I see down here in front, do we have a microphone that can... Yes, the microphone is coming down here in front.
So I've been long thinking if I should ask this question, but I just dare to. We've been talking about like non-living, non-human biology in this panel. And I wanted to ask the synthetic biologist if they are debating maybe as a ambivalence action, like editing of human germline, you know, politics of speed, and, you know, things are, you know, even books are named after the speed of light, you know, this kind of icon of, like, things are speeding up. So within, like, the short history of the contemporary synthetic biology, it seems that synthetic biology has, like, now, you know, like, it's attempt to maybe cross that border to human biology, or even the planned human genome project too, by writing a human genome. So,
yeah, so in terms of human genetic engineering, we're not there yet, but we're indeed getting closer, and people have been starting this debate already now, because biology is, it's starting to develop technologies faster and faster. And for example, there is this project called, well, there was the Human Genome Project, and now there is this Synthetic Genome Project, which I don't know if you heard about, where we're basically using DNA synthesis, ATCs and genes that we can synthesize in the lab, make the first minimal human genome. And so this is like, you have to imagine this like as a challenge for biologists, because on the way we're going to have to develop many technologies. So the goal itself is more like, let's think of something impossible and have fun on the way. But I believe that this is like much more complex. And now there are things like CRISPR. Everyone is talking about it. Everyone is like freaking out. And yeah, and no one knows how to regulate this. How are we going to, who is allowed to change yourself? What are the limits? And I invite you to look at in the internet. There's a person recently that is infected with HIV that injected himself with a CRISPR, hoping to cure himself, because the actual therapeutics that he's using, he's not satisfied with that. And so per se, like the fact that ingesting CRISPR yourself, well, whether if it's sufficient or not, it's interesting. But the real interest is like, okay, how we as people are we going to cope with these technologies, and who is going to tell us to not to do it? How are we going to regulate that, and how you can use that as a powerful tool to actually create our own solutions? And so in this case, you cannot tell this person like, no, don't don't use CRISPR to engineer yourself, right?
I think that also the question...
So the line is very, it's very blurry, and it's very interesting, I think, to think altogether as a species, like, okay, what are we going to do with this technology now?
Yeah. I think that also the question is not whether to use it or not, because unfortunately it will be used one way or the other, because, you know, we can decide here that we'll not use it, but, you know, in China they will use it. So the most important question is how we channel it, or make sure that this is, if it's being used, it's not abused. And because every technology that has a promise has the ability to abuse, and that's definitely one of the worst kind of technology in terms of the potential to be abused. So instead of debating whether or not to use it, we need to start to think how do we prepare ourselves to live in a world in which this is a reality.
What do you think? Who will control it? The politicians? The economy?
I don't know. I really don't. I wish I could. So, you know, hopefully it would be us as a society through our politician, but this is a very naive saying, because, you know, we live in a world in which North Korea can decide by itself, for example, to clone the fierce leader in 10,000 copies. So,
or maybe not. We still don't know if CRISPR is that powerful. I will be interested to see if it will fail, actually.
But, you know, it's not CRISPR, something else, you know.
Yeah, or something else, yeah.
The social realm is never far from the scientific technology, is what I'm hearing. Another question from the audience. Also down here in the blue.
There's so many nice ideas that you've presented this evening, so I just want to thank you for that. The whole time I've been sitting here thinking about the seed and its literal and metaphorical relationship to that which surrounds it, the soil. One of the main ecosystem services or ecosystem functions of the soil is to be a gene pool. So if the seed is a carrier of information, then I'm wondering what you think of the soil.
A very interesting question. I'll just share a quick anecdote. I've been interested to know the etymology of the concept of gene pool and where that came from. And it's not very easy to research. There's one article that somebody has written on it, and I'm not convinced by the argument. But I think it might even come from the card-playing practices of geneticists, that they played games that had cards that were put into a pool in the middle. Because when you look at the early genetics textbooks, there's all sorts of indications and references of genes being illustrated by using playing cards as the example of how traits could mix and match over generations. So I just put that out there as an interesting little anecdote.
So for me, if you're talking about soil, the first association for me is the microbes in the soil, because my work is in microbiology. So you probably know that also in our body, the number of bacterial cells equals the number of human cells. So we are basically a big consortium of human plus bacteria. The same thing is true for soil. So basically, without the bacteria in the soil, if you take soil without bacteria and you put a seed there, probably the evolution will not be, or the development of the seed will be hampered. And this relates also to the Soviet idea of the environment having the effect. So for me, the soil is not just a steady thing. It's not a rock. It's actually a living, breathing community that is essential for any seed that you put inside. But this is my association as a scientist.
I think seeds are nothing without soil, certainly what we can say, that seeds don't work without soil.
So do you have hydroponic? So you can grow plants today without soil.
Which is a form of soil, one might say metaphorically, right? That other things need to be involved in addition to the seed. So
I think I've seen other hands in the audience, though.
Should we do one more? One other hand? What are you seeing? Yes, two hands. I see two hands. All right. Do we have a microphone coming? Oh.
Can I?
The microphone is there already. Okay.
Then there's one down there. I just wanted to pick on a couple of terms that I thought might have ideological kind of residue from engineering paradigm in some way. Not that I find engineering itself a problem, but it's a state. So the two terms are optima, and which came up in Aaron's talk, for example, I think, you know, both of these arguments actually is coming from Giuseppe Longo, who was talking yesterday, and so he's arguing that, you know, there are no optima in nature, and you can think of optima, you know, optima is for something, right? And, you know, evolution is not teleological in this way. So, and the second term is connected to this. So it was a term that Helena brought up, which is robustness. And this is kind of related to kind of the early cybernetic kind of principle of like a robustness to noise, to perturbations from the outside, right? And, you know, there's a whole field of noise biology now, which I think you can argue against, because, you know, really the biological systems are not robust to perturbations, they're resilient, you know, so they're resilient systems that are, you know, where perturbations are functional to the system. So I just wondered how you thought about those ideological implications there.
You want to start? Or?
Okay. And so everything you have said, I completely agree. I think that, talking about, starting from the first point, talking about optima is difficult, I agree, because it's not standing alone, it's not a real mountain there. In every kind of aspect you want to describe, there is a different optima. But if you take Darwin's notion of natural selection, basically the highest fitness would be the optima in this case. But this is something which is very fluidic. So again, unlike a mountain, which is always there, the environment changes all the time. So the optima changes all the time. The fitness changes all the time. So basically, you get to a situation in which there is a crosstalk between the organism which is adapting to the environment and the environment itself, which sometimes adapt to the organism. So it's a complete dynamic process, and the top of the mountain is never reached because the top of the mountain is always changing. So in this regard, I agree that there is no clear optima, but I would say that there's still, you know, increase in fitness toward a given condition, which you can describe as optima, at least in a time framework, which is rather limited.
And to clarify, what I meant by robustness was more the fact that actually when you're trying to apply this engineering logic, organisms are quite resistant to our control. And so that's what I meant. They're robust in terms of like our engineering force of trying to make them behave of a certain way. They tend to go back to, they evolve, and then they just go back to their sort of like whatever feeds them better. And so I meant robust in that regard, but I agree with you that that we're all, and every organism is sensitive to any fluctuations, and it can be affected, yeah.
So one last comment regarding to this. So actually, robustness is a terminology we really like in biology. So there's this new field of systems biology. It's not so new, but there is a field called systems biology in which we try to look at biological phenomena not from the point of view of the parts, but from the point of view of the entire system from an holistic perspective. And in this field, like the name robustness, the terminology robustness is used over and over and over again. So, you know, you can, it's a little bit about semantics, whether resilience versus robustness. I cannot comment about this because, you know, I'm not even a native English speaker. So for me, you know, use whatever terminology you want to use. But in systems biology, the notion of robustness, that a system that knows to go to its original state, is it's a very powerful and overused. You go to conferences, you hear it all the time, robustness, robustness, robustness.
So it sounds like a good thing to discuss over further drinks later. But I think we have time for one more question. Is that the organizers? Okay, so we had one more question right over here. The two hands before.
Thank you so much. It was a very interesting panel. Really appreciated it. I think I'd like to circle back, and we'll obviously end on the comment on semantics and the word seed. I'm curious why the egg is not understood as a seed, and why, in fact, in Lewis, in your presentation, you referred to some kind of spermatozoa thing coming from, I don't know, the other world.
The idea of panspermia,
yeah,
is what it had been called.
And I found that really fascinating, mm-hmm. The degree to which the kind of obsession, really, with the male genitalia, or, in fact, you know, the sperm, is the life-giving force. And it was a kind of relief to see that the women, coming from all different positions here, did focus on rethinking seed, rethinking engineering outside of the tropes that were given. So my question is, that's an observation. My question is, do you think, does the panel think, and it'd be nice to hear from Nobotic actually, but does the panel think that pleasure can in fact also be part of this seed thing? And that by pleasure I mean erotic sexual pleasure, or is that, quote, just the field of the living organism outside of the bots?
Okay, Nobotic, I'll turn that to you. It's a great question.
I'm not sure how to answer, but I think pleasure for us, also with the decision for the performances to do it not like a lecture or using word, but go into opulence, go in the ornamentic, go in the not baroque, but a kind of so that you can't control it. You know, there is a lot of things you can't control if you go in this topic. And that what we, that as you said, go over the seed, go over the soil, and go deep, all in this kind what you can't control, because that's, I think, our intention, that there is no control for that. There is no focus on the smallest thing. So you have to go like planetarism or like more. And also, therefore, you have to find some other connection, some other kind of sexuality, some other kind of aesthetics.
Sure. I mean, so with regard to panspermia, obviously, the word sperm has very long connotations that go back to the classical period about the relationship between male seed as being form and then the female matrix being mere substance, right? And then you can get into Cartesian discussions about the relationship between whether matter is more important or whether form or information is more important, which circles back to what we were talking about before. I've been on a one-woman mission to get rid of the word seminal for years now without any impact whatsoever. I just can't stand it as an adjective. But I take your point about the importance of pleasure. And one of the things I was thinking about while Luis was presenting his material is one of Evelyn Fox Keller, well, actually, Evelyn Fox Keller's first book as a historian of biology. She has had many careers as a physicist and as a biologist and mathematician as well, or mathematical biologist. Once she moved into feminist history of science, she wrote a biography of Barbara McClintock, and one of the central claims that she made was the reason why McClintock succeeded despite all odds was because she took pleasure in the organisms that she studied, and that there was a particular kind of feminist practice of science that was radically different than how other people were looking at and understanding not just maize, but also how they were reading it in order to look for things like jumping genes, and that she wouldn't have succeeded had she not had that kind of pleasure and feeling for the object of her study.
I think if I can add one more anecdote to that, the late 19th century engineering ideal in biology that I was referring to is often associated with Jacques Loeb, and one of his great discoveries was the invention of what he called artificial parthenogenesis, that he would take sea urchin eggs, and without them being fertilized, he would change the saltwater concentrations and cause them to begin to divide and to develop. And so there you have an egg-centered approach to reproduction, which he held was the great vision of a future mechanistic understanding of life. And the book that he wrote about this, called The Mechanistic Conception of Life, was a pun in English. The mechanistic conception of life and the mechanistic conception of life at the same time. So I think there are many rich details that we could explore further on that theme. Well, I realize that we are nearing the end of our time here, and we don't want to keep you from dinner, but there is a thought in my mind from the geneticist Dobzhansky, and he said, "It is quite literally true that a man is a conglomeration of transformed groceries." So with that, I wish you a good dinner, and we'll see you back for the next session. Thank you all.